From the Supreme Court in Washington, D.C., ABC News presents a conversation with the Chief Justice. This unprecedented half-hour, unedited discussion was recorded for radio and television with Chief Justice Warren E. Burger on July 1st, before he left for New York, where earlier today he made his annual report on the state of the judiciary before the American Bar Association. The Chief Justice talked with ABC News National Affairs editor Bill Lawrence.
Mr. Chief Justice, I was very interested in this statue you have here of justice riding on the back of a turtle. Is that an adequate symbol for the law in the last third of the 20th century?
Well, first I have to correct your supposition. It's a tortoise, not a turtle, and there's a considerable difference in size, if not speed, Mr. Lawrence. No, the tortoise has been a symbol of the law for much longer than the blindfolded lady with the scales. And you notice the artist here has got something resembling a scales involved in his allegorical piece. But the tortoise is there because of the concept of the ancients that the law should develop slowly, not that it should function slowly. So that the symbolism has got to be put in the right place.
Well, I never was much of an animal man, but now that I've been brought up to date on the difference between the tortoise and the turtle, it does seem to me, though, that the Pentagon Papers didn't get here on the back of a tortoise, but they came up rather swiftly and were decided very promptly, unlike an awful lot of cases that come to this court. What's your comment on that?
Well, first, Mr. Lawrence, although the court was actually unanimous yesterday on the basic problems of First Amendment rights of newspapers, we judges and justices give up our First Amendment rights to some extent, and we can't comment about cases past, present, future, or even those of yesterday. That's out of bounds for us in terms of comment.
Well, isn't it unusual, though, to have 9 separate opinions on a constitutional issue like this?
It's unusual, Mr. Lawrence, but it was not unique. I think, although I'm not sure, that the Steele seizure case of some years ago had separate opinions. And, of course, when the court's under such pressure as we were placed by a case of that kind, the simplest thing to do in getting it out in a hurry is each justice states what's on his mind. This is the common practice in England, something they're getting away from. Usually, of course, we manage to have a single majority opinion and then separate opinions.
We were here today.
Not so many of them as we had yesterday.
We're here today to talk about your report on the state of the judiciary, which you delivered to the American Bar Association earlier. As the Chief Justice of the United States, as well as the presiding jurist of the Supreme Court, how goes the battle for law and order?
Well, there again, I'd rather put it in terms of something other than law and order, because that's become a stereotype, cliche sort of thing. The battle, if you want to put it that way, for improved courts is something that's been going on for many, many years. I hope it's going in some forward direction right now, and I think in some respects it is, as my report to the American Bar indicated.
Now, there was a single sentence in your speech today that was in capital letters, and that sentence said, "There must be finality at some point." I suppose you were referring there to your unhappiness with lengthy and perhaps unnecessary appeal procedures.
Well, in the first place, Mr. Lawrence, the the fact that that was in uppercase type is something simply for the convenience of the person who's got to use the text of the speech as his notes when he delivers it. It had no other significance. Yes, there must be finality. The very idea of bringing any matter, whether it's a civil case or a criminal case, into the courts is to take a lot of conflicts that have existed and narrow them down to some issues and then get them disposed of. And when we have repeated appeals and repeated trials and attacks on convictions in criminal cases interminably after the judgment has been rendered, this is not good. We in this country afford more reviews than in any other system of law anywhere in the world. Now, we should give every kind of review that's reasonable, but a case shouldn't have to be tried five or six times with five or six appeals.
Well, just what do you do to accomplish the end that you seek?
To eliminate this multiplicity of appeals and trials is a very difficult thing. Some of this is part of a transition that we're in, Mr. Lawrence. For generations, we've neglected the administration of criminal law in this country. Beginning about 30 years ago, the courts and the legal profession began to be more sensitive to it. And this has continued at an accelerated pace. In the process of doing this, a great many standards were changed. And the message about the new ground rules doesn't always get down to the local levels of prosecutors and defense lawyers. And as a result, errors are made and they must be corrected. That's the function of an appellate court. So I'm not in any sense disparaging or attacking the idea of a review of convictions by appeal, but simply saying we must put our house in order so that we don't have to try one criminal case five times or six times over a period of 8, 10 years.
Well, do you do this by law, by regulation of the court, by new rules?
A good deal of it depends upon the quality of the advocates, the lawyers. And a great deal is being done in that direction, to upgrade the performance of both the prosecutor and the defense counsel in criminal cases. And when we get it to an adequate level, that alone will eliminate a great many of the problems.
I travel around this country a great deal, Mr. Chief Justice, and I suppose if there's one complaint I hear more than any other, it is the long delay in adjudicating cases, whether criminal or civil. Is this something that we can expect any results on in the near future?
Well, that's a valid objection, valid complaint. It does take too long. There are many, many causes for that. One of them is that the growth of the country and the enormous growth of new kinds of litigation, the increase in the crime rate and the consequent increase in the number of prosecutions has simply flooded the courts, and the courts can't keep up. That's part of it.
Well, now, in your speech today, you talked about the Supreme Court, and you said to the bar that we cannot keep up with the volume of work and maintain a quality historically expected from the court. Then you went on to emphasize that 9 justices must now deal with approximately 4,000 filings each year, as compared with 1,100 filings in 1940 and 1,300 in 1950. How many cases did the court hear and actually decide this year?
I think our figures, which were just completed within, as a matter of fact, an hour or so, Mr. Lawrence, showed that we argued 151 cases in 1970. Now, of course, the argued cases are not any measure of the work we do because we dispose of thousands of cases without argument. That's the measure this year, 151 cases as against 144 the previous year and 140 the year before that. I suspect very strongly that next year it will go up again. Now, it's obvious that a court can't... A court which remains stable in its size can't absorb a 10% increase every year.
Well, now you're talking. You just said that. A court that remains stable in its size. Are you advocating in any way an increase in the size of this court?
Oh, no, not at all.
Well, how would
you deal? I was just emphasizing to you that it is a stable number, and historically, traditionally, that's been true and isn't likely to change. I'm simply saying that we must control in some way the input.
Well, in other words, you would restrict jurisdiction.
That's one approach to it.
And how would you do that?
Well, we can't do it at all. Only Congress can do that under the Constitution. And that's a very delicate business that must be approached very, very carefully. I think members of Congress are conscious of it. The American Law Institute, at the request of Chief Justice Earl Warren, conducted a survey, which unfortunately took about 9 years to complete, on this very subject. And they have made recommendations which have been passed on to the Congress. Congress is engaged in studying those proposals now to reduce some of the jurisdiction of federal courts generally, and that will have an impact on the Supreme Court.
Well, I remember a long time ago when the issue of increasing the court was raised by Franklin Roosevelt, that one of the big arguments that Mr. Chief Justice Hughes made in defeating the court plan was that the court could keep up with its work.
Well, it could in those days, reasonably, but the figures you just cited out of the report on the judiciary that I made to the bar shows the increase since Mr. Hughes' day. I think Chief Justice Hughes retired in 1941, and what was the 1940 figure there?
Well, it was 1,100 in 1940.
Well, we have more than 4,000 now.
And are these cases of substance, or are a lot of these handwritten cases that have been coming out of the federal prisons of, or the, you know, the jailhouse lawyers?
Yes, but a handwritten case from a jailhouse lawyer, to take your terms, Mr. Lawrence, might present an important question. And every petition which is filed in this court receives the individual attention of each of 9 justices. There is no way of avoiding that.
I've heard it argued by some lawyers that actually to increase the court would be to slow it down. Because instead of getting 9 men
well,
to agree, you'd need 15 or
I
whatever
would not,
number you chose.
I would not want to express a view about what the size of the Supreme Court should be, but I was on the Court of Appeals in Washington for nearly 14 years before I came up here. That was a 9-man court. I finished that 14 years experience with a firm conviction that 9 men is the maximum workable number for a multiple judge court.
Let's turn to another issue that you raised in your speech to the bar today, where you said that this profession, meaning the lawyers, simply has to regulate itself, or it's going to be regulated from the outside, and perhaps that time has already arrived. So what do you mean by that?
Well, in this country, Mr. Lawrence, with our federal system and our concepts of federalism, each state is in exclusive control of the standards for admission to the bar, the standards of legal education, the standards of discipline and control, regulation of lawyers. Now, we start with the proposition that the legal profession is in the nature of a monopoly of an essential public service. And it is almost an article of faith with us in this country that monopolies should be regulated. Traditionally, the lawyers have been thought to regulate themselves. That's what's done in England. In this country, with 50 different states involved, and the District of Columbia making 51 jurisdictions, there is no common plan. And as a practical matter, there is virtually no meaningful regulation or discipline of misconduct. And this can be very important to little people more than big corporations and affluent people.
There have been some criticisms of the Supreme Court in recent years. Questions have been raised of judicial ethics, both of members of the court, prospective members of the court, nominees to the court, contacts with the executive branch of the government while sitting on the bench. What, if anything, has been done to correct these previous cases where they did involve sitting justices?
About 5 years ago, Mr. Lawrence, the American Bar Association came to the realization that the canons of judicial ethics, which had been promulgated in, I think, 1923 by a committee chaired by Chief Justice Taft while he was Chief Justice, were somewhat out of date, and that the same was true about the canons of legal ethics. And a great enterprise was launched. Studies were taken to bring them up to date. The codes of professional responsibility for lawyers were brought up to date. More specific standards were developed for the prosecution and defense counsel. And another study committee has produced an up-to-date set of standards of judicial conduct. They have been the subject of hearings, and I believe they are going to be passed upon by the American Bar in the next few days. The committee for that, by the way, was chaired by Chief Justice Roger Traynor of the California Supreme Court, since retired. And among others, Justice Potter Stewart of the Supreme Court was a member of the committee. They will have these standards, I think, finally approved at this meeting.
Well, now, as Chief Justice, do you have any contact with the executive branch other than social or in the courtroom?
Social and in the courtroom, and then the necessary incidental contacts relating to the proceedings in the court. The Solicitor General of the United States is a constant litigant in our court, and there are communications. Traditionally, and it is true right up to this very day, the Solicitor General is very scrupulous about any communication except the mechanical procedural matters relating to the conduct of a case. Otherwise, no, I have no contact. I hardly have time to be doing anything else.
Well, no, but in the past, justices have been criticized because they gave the president advice, perhaps on non-judicial matters, like the war.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the first place, I don't think my advice would be very valuable on any of these subjects, Mr. Lawrence, but in the second place, it hasn't been asked for, and I've never been drawn into it. I think the president had something to say about that in a press conference the day after I was nominated. He said, in substance, when asked about the relationship between a chief justice, any chief justice, and the president, my recollection is he said the relationship should be correct, but arm's length.
And that's the way it's remained.
The president is a lawyer. I'm a lawyer. We both understand this. I'm sure that that's the way it should be done and is being done.
You've now been Chief Justice, Mr. Berger, for two full terms. What do you regard as the most significant decisions that have come from your court in that period?
That's a little bit like saying, trying to say, who was the best heavyweight champion? What was the best football team that ever played? It would be particularly difficult in the 2 years ending yesterday. The scholars and students who are court watchers have said and written that this last year had more of what are called great cases in quotation marks than any term of court in history. That may or may not be true. We certainly had our share of them. In both years, there were a great many important cases. I don't think I could pinpoint any one. I do note, and all justices note, that the cases which the media naturally give attention to often overlook some cases that are really very important. And that doesn't remain so for a long time because the law reviews and learned journals cover them. Sometimes they're not of great public interest, but have great significance and impact.
Well, could you mention a case or two that to you stand as kind of landmarks of the so-called Burger Court?
Well, I'd have to reject your characterization. The court doesn't really warrant anybody's name being attached to it, Mr. Lawrence. I think there's one case that has been commented on a great deal by others as having been, I think one writer said, a sleeper, using that in quotation marks. It was Griggs against the Duke Power Company, having to do with equal employment opportunities and the limits on the kind of testing that could be used. I wouldn't want to say that that was one of the terribly important cases, but experts in that field of law consider it so, but it's not the kind of a case that received any public attention.
Well, now, there was a case that interested me, sir. I think it was about a year ago the Supreme Court approved a state law in Florida permitting six-man juries in criminal cases. And I think that since then there have been the use of six-man juries in civil cases in some of the federal jurisdictions. Is this a trend? Is there anything magic about 12 or 6 or 3 or...
Well, there's nothing any more magic about 6 than there is about 12. As a matter of fact, in writing that opinion, Justice White made a statement something like that, that there was no magic in 12. It was something that had come down by tradition and historical practice. And the holding of the court was that the states, Florida in that instance, could use six-member juries instead of 12. There are other states that have long used fewer than 12 jurors. I am informed that a dozen or 15 federal districts, by rule in their own district, have adopted a six-man jury in the past year.
On civil cases?
Yes, on civil cases only, not on criminal. No court has undertaken to do that. As far as I know, there's no consideration been given to reducing the criminal jury. About a year ago, I had the subject of the size of the jury on the agenda as something that needed very serious and urgent study.
Well, in your report to the bar today, you refer to the large number of jurors that have been summoned over the year and the expanse. Is it possible that we could have six-man juries in civil as well as criminal cases without doing injury to the law or to justice?
Well, that's why this experience in the states which use smaller jurors, juries, and the experience in these federal districts should be studied very carefully. The lawyers may conclude that it works just as well. If they do, then there will be a trend developing. We spend $14 million a year in the federal system alone for juries, and if we could cut it down to half, we could, of course, save quite a lot of money. No one really knows until the experience has been studied. I'm inclined to think that may develop.
Well, I suppose that $14 million for a jury, if justice is at stake, isn't really very much money in this kind of government that we run.
Oh, that's
right.
But
I take it that you think that justice could be done with fewer jurors.
I think we'll know, and the bar will know a great deal more about that. And so far, with the experience of the states, where they've done this for a long, long time, my own adopted state of Virginia has done this for many, many years. It may be that the bar and the profession generally will conclude that 6 is as good as 12. They might even conclude 5 is as good as 12.
5 at least would give us an uneven number and perhaps not a divided jury. I was interested in your talk at the American Law Institute about the need for greater civility in the courts. Your chief target there seemed to be the lawyers who misbehave. Is there any problem with judges who are not civil to lawyers?
I suppose judges must be regarded as just as human as the lawyers. Over my practice before I became a judge, and that was 20 years of active practice, I found some uncivil judges. They were rather difficult to deal with. I ran into uncivil lawyers. They're difficult to deal with. The whole litigation process will break down unless everybody involved in the process conducts himself with reasonable civility.
Well, now,
that's a very important part. It's the lubricant that makes the system work, because the system is basically a contentious thing. And this is why the amenities have got to be followed.
In your speech about civility, though, you talked about the news media on 5 different occasions. How do we get in this fight?
Well, of course, if you make a careful comparison, you'll see that I talked about the lawyers and the judges probably 10 times as much as I did the media. What I was referring to in terms of the media was the historical fact that 100 years ago, newspapers were uniformly and almost universally intemperate, uncivil. And this then reflected itself in all the aspects of life, in the courtrooms, in the Congress. Congressmen would get in fistfights on the floor of the Congress. I was simply suggesting, by referring to the press, that when there is widespread incivility and it becomes pervasive, it has a hydraulic thrust that pushes it everywhere.
Well, now, you said in that speech, though, that long ago it was not uncommon for political leaders to horsewhip newspaper reporters. Were you maybe talking about the good old days?
No, Mr. Lawrence. Someone asked me whether there was a wistful note in that. Not at all. I was suggesting that, again, when it gets out of hand, this is what happens. And this did happen 100 years ago and more. We've just got to have a pervasive civility in dealing with all our problems. And it's more important when the problems are difficult than when the problems are easy.
We've got about a minute left, Mr. Chief Justice. How would you enforce this civility if lawyers, judges, and the media don't voluntarily do it?
Well, of course, we can't do anything about the media. This is a matter of self-restraint. We can do something about lawyers and judges who are not civil. And that's why I am proposing in this speech, and I'm going to repeat some of that in London when we meet there, that there must be an examination of the standards and then strict enforcement when those standards are violated, whether by judges or lawyers.
Would it be better, perhaps, to have made this report to the Congress than the American Bar?
Well, the legal profession is primarily concerned with these problems. It might be useful to make it to Congress, but I think it's more important to make it to the American Bar Association.
Well, I'm afraid we are out of time, Mr. Chief Justice. I thank you for being with us. This is Bill Lawrence. Good night.
Pleasure to be here, Mr. Lawrence.
Conversation with the Chief Justice was recorded in the Justice's Library at the Supreme Court in Washington, D.C. It was the first time that a Chief Justice granted a personal interview to one reporter on primetime radio and television.